Welcome to Season 10, Episode 17 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we once again have Mike Myler back on talking about his latest Kickstarter. Again, welcome to Season 10, Episode 17 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff, and joining us, me this episode is Chris. And, of course, Mike is here because, well, he's the guest of honor. Welcome.
Indeed. Thank you for having me. I didn't realize I was a guest of honor, so now I feel like I'm underdressed.
Man. No top hat or tie required.
Exactly. You laugh at our jokes, therefore you're awesome.
So. My top hat's with the chapeau. Oh, I forgot the name of the hat person. Balderdash? Balder? No, it's gone. There used to be a name for a hat guy.
Haberdasher.
Yes.
Haberdasher, that's what it is. My haberdasher's out of town.
Sweet.
Yes, I don't know where that was that I knew that one. It was like a question somewhere. And I think somebody looked at me funny, like I knew what that was. You know, because it was like a question like on Jeopardy or something like that. And I'm like, I know that one.
Well, all gamers, and therefore we know all these.
We know all
no
these weird things.
Ancient medieval professions.
Well, I don't even think a haberdasher was necessarily a quite a medieval profession. I mean, I think that went all the way up into the 1800s, at least.
I'd say early 1900s.
Yeah.
When they started mass producing hats, I think was the end of the haberdashery.
Yeah. Well, such as it is, you know. Mm-hmm. What was the other one? I think because there was another term that I can't remember off the top of my head, and it had something to do with a men's clothing store or something that had a particular name, and I knew that one, and I can't think of it now.
Like a belt guy?
No, like a clothing store.
That sounds like just something you go.
Yeah, you go get.
I don't know.
You go get your belt at the tanner, right?
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right, well, why don't we just dive right in? So you do have another Kickstarter. When does it kick off officially?
This is a reboot because Imperial Matchmaker, we figured out somewhere around halfway it was not going to work out. This should be launching on September 3rd or September 4th, Monday or Tuesday.
Okay, so right around Labor Day. Interesting choice for the U.S.
Oh, yeah, we have a holiday next week, don't we?
Yeah.
Labor Day or something?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, but that's okay. You know, it just means more people will be in front of the computers like, what am I doing today? I don't know. Let's look at the Kickstarters. Hey, that looks interesting. Maybe I'll buy that. So you said this was a reboot, you said, sort of, because you're having...
Yes. I came on a couple months ago for Imperial Matchmaker, and yeah, we might have made it. Like, there was a chance where if we pushed, we could have gotten funding, but I thought better of it and, you know, retooled everything and did a whole bunch of work in between then and now.
Well, I mean, like, kind of what kind of retooling are we talking about here? Was it a change in scope?
Scope and funding level, and I got one of the books completely finished.
Okay.
So I used like what resources I have to make Trade War, which is like an adventure path. And then I've already done most of the conversion work to make it into Shadow of the Demon Lord, because I was the first licensor of Shadow of the Demon Lord, so I have Mists of Akuma, you can pick it up for Shadow of the Demon Lord. And both of the adventures now, you can pick them up in 5e or Shadow of the Demon
Lord. That's cool. Yeah, maybe we should... Mike, you should give your elevator speech just in case this is their first time coming into the podcast. Let them know about the awesomeness that is Mists of Akuma and your project that you're going to be chilling shortly.
160 years ago, foreigners appeared across the Great Divide, which is this giant energy wall at the edge of the world where the sea just kind of falls off into waterfalls to going to nowhere. And they used their superior technology to subjugate all the people of Silberin and draft them into this war called the War of Kaio, happening on the other side of that huge energy wall. This continued for about 100 years until all communications with the foreigners' countries just shut off. So the Kangan occupation kind of kept control for another 5 decades until finally the people of Soberin rebelled and put the rightful Emperor Hitoshi back on the throne. And they had about like 10 years of good times where people were able to recover from the war and, you know, find their families, start over, that kind of thing. Then the Mists of Akuma appear. And the Mists of Akuma are this primordial fog that strips people of their dignity and transforms them into Adedo Oni, which are like fast, high-jumping, very slightly intelligent undead. And if you're, in the cases of like inanimate objects, it can artificially age them. And in Soberin, after 100 years, any item that's still, you know, together has a chance of becoming a Tsukumugami, which is a lot like a mimic. And it'll be either good or bad depending on how it was treated when it was inanimate. So, you know, if your family's treasured umbrella, for instance, might be really helpful and chatty and a good companion. But in case of weapons of war, they're almost always violent. So even though technology is probably what could save Soberin from the Mists of Akuma, there is a heretical fear of technology because it might throw teeth and bite you.
Yeah, basically, the last thing you want to do is get your Kami out of you.
Exactly, exactly. And yeah, especially artillery pieces and stuff like that, it's a serious issue if it's a, like a mounted train gun that suddenly changes into a monster.
Yeah, nobody wants to give them a bad side of a Gatling gun.
To facilitate like saving Soberin and to, you know, get adventures going, the Emperor Hitoshi has a bunch of these very special government officers called Bengoshi, who are all badasses in their own right. All the prefectures have their own kind of Bengoshi. And the Bengoshi are empowered to deputize people under like threat of imprisonment or death to go and undertake specific missions for the state. So, yeah, you and your adventuring party kind of go around getting hired by Bengoshi / ordered by Bengoshi to go and deal with the various threats across Soberin, and that's the Mists of Akuma.
Wow.
Okay.
That sounds worse than being pressed into the British service.
Can be.
Absolutely. Okay. Give us a day in the life of one of your games. Like, you know, what is the standard game for, say, Mists of Akuma for, you know, what's the kind of the hook, line, sinker kind of a narrative flow?
Sure. Well, it's Eastern Fantasy Noir. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go right ahead, man. No, it's your nickel. Go for it.
Oh. See, noir, steampunk, and it's very specifically in that order. So, like, you can pull the steampunk out because everybody's heretically afraid of it, and all the prefectures that embrace it are on the outsides of the island. So you just kind of, like, pull 4 prefectures out, and you have more medieval, standard kind of Japan fantasy. But when you win, it's not like in your regular D&D game. There might be some glory, and maybe you manage to save some people, but chances are good that a lot of people will suffer or die, and all your victories should be Pyrrhic, right? Hmm. So that is to say that they will require sacrifice and loss to achieve.
Indeed.
But yeah, the standard day for most people, for adventuring, one of the common tropes in the adventure is that whenever you show up to a new settlement, the Mists of Akuma appear like nearby, so you've got to like rush into the settlement, and it's kind of fun as a GM watching players get up. Like, so they develop different strategies to deal with it. So, like, I have one group that's like always like, okay, get people evacuated in towards the center of the town, and we'll create a wall with the guards, and we'll make a living wall and get people to high ground. And I have another group who's just they just get to the town, the mists show up, and it's everybody for themselves.
Yeah,
dealing with the Mists of Akuma is a major problem. And depending on what prefecture you're in, there are different ways they take care of it. So, like, the one, the prefecture where I think it's Kuruzu, where all the Kappa, the Tortles, they're called in the DM's Guild, all the turtle folk got subjugated and sent there during the Kangan occupation, because all the prefectures got sent one of the inhuman races to, like, pen up and imprison during the occupation. So they, when the mists show up, the nobles force the people to carry around giant metal, like iron shells that they just kind of like get under and drop, which causes horrible, horrible things to their ears and other. You can't do stuff like that with pressure without your body's reacting poorly. And then, like, the Namida, who were all way into timber and logging before the Kangen occupation just, like, stripped all their forests down to nothing. They have these, like, weird stone fluted things in the ground where you go in and you toss as much burnable material as you can, and the natural smoke kind of pushes the mists away. So, yeah. It's mostly about dealing with the mists.
Yeah.
And all the undead rolling around them.
Yeah. I was going to say something about how one of the villages sounds like duck and cover. Only instead of Cold War, it's like a medieval Japan version. Yeah. I already know the answer to this, but I got to ask it. I take it you're a Ninja Scroll fan?
I am a Ninja Scroll fan. Did you know they made an animated series out of Ninja Scroll?
Yes.
Did you hear arguments of this thing? I will say no.
I mean, like, are you serious? Because it's not that bad. It's worth watching.
No, I'm just saying it just so we have narrative flow.
Oh.
Okay. No, I've actually heard of it. I've just like never seen it. Yeah. So,
well, yeah. To this day, one of my favorite villains is the one with the hunchback with the beehive or bug hive on the back of his back.
It's pretty cool. I thought the stone guy was like straight up really creepy, disturbing.
Yeah. And part of the fun with monsters is, well, you build them and you make them so, well, they're not supposed to be normal in the first place. And that explains that. Okay, so I guess you have a Kickstarter. Tell us all about it.
Yeah, Mists of Akuma was funded on Kickstarter back in 2016. So Mists of Akuma is out. You can get it. This Kickstarter is to fund two different adventures, one of which is done, at least for 5e. That's the Adventure Path Trade War. And I will, you guys should share the YouTube link with the long walkthrough. I'm not going to do the 12-minute walkthrough here without any visual examples.
Yeah,
but there's a video where I walk through every page of the book. it's great. It takes you all over Soberin and has some tropes like the Mubo Brothers. I'm not going to get into it. Anyway. So that's a fun Adventure Path. Breaking. That's very cool. Yeah, unlike most of the Mists of Akuma stuff, which is city-centric because it's noir, that one goes all over the place.
Yeah, I believe it involves something involving a wedding.
That's the second one. So you watched the whole video. What did you think?
Well, let me take a look here. It looked okay. Like, I have no problems with that whatsoever here. Still got to give it some thought before I give a full rundown, though.
But
it grabbed me, it presented well, and what else can you say?
Cool. So, one recommendation to watch the video. That's two recommendations to watch the video now.
I always say it's always nice to have something that someone's showing you that you can, so you can make a more better informed decision whether it's something you want or not. So I always say watch a video if there is something. I mean, even if it's stupid, like, let's face it, on the internet, there are a lot of what I'm going to call unboxing videos. You just see what's in the box of a product, and it's stupid. But I always tell people, somebody was like, that's so stupid. I'm like, on the other hand, the reason people do them is because sometimes it's like, oh, hey, I get to see that item in actually somebody's hand, even if they don't tell me really about that item. I can see, okay, that's the actual size. This is what's actually in the box versus what they claim's in the box. And, most guys would give you at least a little tidbit of what's going on with it before they, So that's why I always say, whatever. I think that's the big thing about, especially like YouTube videos for a lot of people with products. It's like, hey, you can get people kind of showing you the product. If the person selling the product can talk about it, or if there's someone doing a full-on review, it's good. I mean, don't get me wrong. I still like written reviews of things. But sometimes, the visual helps sell it. So.
Indeed.
Sounds like three recommendations to watch the walkthrough video. Trade War is cool. And those adventures are already all done. So if you're not interested in the adventure path, like, you can pick them up in, print in softback. But obviously, I think the huge book is better.
Yeah, because.
And that's the one adventure. Oh,
because how big is that book? You said it was pretty. I mean, you said in the walkthrough, but it's pretty big.
Like 50 maps. 50 maps. I didn't even realize I made 50 maps for that thing until I counted them out. I was like, son of a bitch, I'm making 50 maps.
Yep.
It's the first
part. You get into the art of creation, you basically just start going and going and going, and then you get to a point where you look back and go, wow, I did that.
Yeah, just kind of get your head down and start working and stuff, and then you don't even look up until you're 3 miles ahead, and you're like, what the hell?
Yeah.
So, I guess, I mean, here's always the other question. Obviously, you said you did it for 5th edition, and obviously you're doing it for Shadow of the Demon Lord. How different, you know, this is always one of the things I always tell people. It's like, I always find it, you know, fascinating when you have something that's for more than one system. It's like, how, I mean, there's mechanical differences, but, and I know obviously you designed this, so it's hard to ask this, but, you know, I'm not going to say obviously don't play the 5th edition, don't play Shadow of the Demon Lord if that's your favorite game, but what would you say is probably one of the bigger differences between trying to do the two versions, you know, or I wouldn't even say conversion, but I'm just going to say, you know, obviously slightly different things. What's probably one of the biggest things that you've noticed as the designer?
Well, in Shadow of the Demon Lord, there's only half as many levels. You only have 10 character levels, right? As opposed to D&D 5th, which is 20. And attributes work a little differently, but all told, when you're translating stuff, it's not the signifiers I would hang on to here are simulation and narrative, right? So, for instance, translating something from Pathfinder to D&D 5th edition is not that hard, because Pathfinder is like, we might say 70-75% simulation, 25% narrative, and D&D 5th edition is like 60-65% simulation and the rest narrative. But if you were to try to translate it to something like Fate, for instance, where it's like 80% narrative, 20% simulation, that's a lot harder of a bridge to build, you know?
Yeah. Well, again, the trick is making sure you have a balance between, well, you're playing a game or you're telling a story. Because, again, different games have different balances when it comes to that sort of thing.
Exactly. It's just about like what tools are there that you can use and whether or not they're available.
Well, because I was just thinking in my mind, I remember, I mean, obviously, I don't even know when it happened. I don't know if it was like during AD&D 1st edition or around AD&D 2nd edition. But I remember at one point, it had to be later, because I remember Gax was no longer at TSR. But, you know, at a certain point, people were trying to make almost like system-neutral, almost adventures or concepts. And I always thought that was very fascinating, because I'm always thinking, yes, you know, and I think this carries over into always my thought about the translation problem, for especially when it comes to the simulation portion, because I've always felt that at a certain level, a game system, you have the game system mechanics, which is kind of the physics of the universe at a certain level, and
yeah.
There are some things that it's like, okay, in one game system you may actually have a character class that's kind of that's a druid, but in another game system you might not have anything like that. The closest you might get is some sort of cleric or priest. And it's always interesting when people have to do those types of translations, because, you know, because obviously spell systems might work differently. You know, one might be like, you know, more like I, you know, like D&D more Vancian, and then another system might be, oh, it's just straight PowerPoints. You know, if you go like, you know, it's like, you know, making an adventure that both D&D 5th editions and Savage Worlds, it's like you can kind of have the same characters, but they're not really going to be the same. Does that make any sense?
No. It's basically going to be a homage where suddenly one character becomes, they might change classes, they might change skills, that sort of thing.
Resource based still? Isn't it just, it's like a second edition revamp, isn't it?
What?
I messed up confused. Sword and Sorcery, or I think it's Sword and Wizardry.
Well, I was just saying.
I'm messing up all my S's and W's, right? Right.
Yes.
Right. Savage Worlds, is that resource based?
No, they have skills and attributes and are all rated in dice.
Right. But it's not like you're the wizard. You have four spell slots for today.
No, you're right. Instead, they use more of a PowerPoint system where you have powers, which are the spells. So
sure, but they're an infinite use kind of deal.
Yeah. But I'm just saying it's always
okay, then that...
To me it's like it's always I can't imagine the trouble that a designer has when he's like, "Oh yeah, I have this, you know, setting and I have to make a version of it for one system and a version for another system," and it's like that has to drive, you know, people mad at a certain level, because it's like, you know, when you know, at least for me as a game master, when I design something, a lot of times I kind of design it from what I call the rule/physics version of it. It's like, you know, I might have an idea, but I have to translate that into that system, and that for maybe I've used that character in that system quite a lot, and now I want to, it's like I might be playing another system and I want to have that same character in a different system, and obviously trying to do that translation, you know, it's kind of like I think what you said, Chris, it's like it's more of a homage to that original character rather than the actual character itself. It's like you create like a alternate universe version of that person, and it's not really the same person.
Well, it's no different than you trying to translate, say, a superhero from a comic to a movie. You know, you're going to get the essence, but you're not going to get a perfect example, and you also don't want it because it's a different game engine.
Right.
Different system.
No,
different medium.
I got a design example for you.
Okay.
So with HyperCore 2099, it was like my second Kickstarter. And the idea was, you remember Mythic Rules from Pathfinder? Mythic Adventures, I think they called it. If you didn't read it, it was great. You should. It's wonderful. It was their answer to Epic Play, right? They were like, we don't want to make 21st level rogues or whatever. So they made this rules template that you just kind of throw onto the regular Pathfinder rules, and then you make demigods. And your demigod could be 1st level or 10th level or 15th level. It didn't matter what their mythic rank was, determined their demigod stuff, right? This is a great concept that I loved it to death. And the way it worked was, in effect, it made everybody too invincible. So we made something like that for HyperCore, but, you know, instead of making demigods, you made superheroes, right? It's the HyperCore system.
Huh.
Fucking amazing. Yep. You can make anything with it. If you go to my website, you'll even find me making stuff for it. I haven't done posts in a while, but it's like Mr. Fantastic, the Hulk. Like, there's like 30 or 40 Marvel characters that are just perfectly set up with HyperCore. Then we wanted to do it for 5th edition as like a stretch goal. Did not work right. Like, the number ceiling on attributes, for instance, was one something that we just kept hitting our heads against it. And eventually we were like, okay, you know what? We can make this work for like X-Men level superheroes, and that's where we're just going to have to cap it. Because... Yeah. The way the rest of the system worked, there was just no way to subvert the rules enough to do the things that we could in the Pathfinder version, partly because there just wasn't as much of a basis in simulation, so like yeah, and really the number cap with what kid is that attribute ceiling just made it impossible. So there you go. There's a real world example where I ran into like, oh god, this just won't translate. Can we make this work? No, we can't.
Yeah.
No, I mean, and that's kind of what I was kind of curious. That's just what I was kind of curious about was, you know, it's like, you know, there's always translation issues, and it's like, you know, it's like I'm always in awe of people that can, like you said, impart the essence of one character from one system to another, and in some way that's workable, and then other times just like, it's the same character. You can obviously, as from a role-playing standpoint, you can portray the same personality, but then it's just like, hopefully I just never have to worry about the mechanical side of it, if you will.
I mean, ideally, like finally at the point where I know in advance, like, okay, I know that I need to make this for also Shadow the Demon Lord. So there's certain things that I could have done with 5e that I chose not to. Just because it's going to make the translation more cogent, and at the end of the day, the two versions will look more like one another than if I had just purely made one for 5e and then translated over without thinking in my head the whole time, like, hey, buddy, you're going to have to take this over here soon. You know?
No, that's good. That's good to know, because, I mean, that's always, because, you know, there's always going to be that person that's like, well, which version's the more truer version, if you will? I know we've seen lots of Kickstarters.
You get an Arts and Game Room. Yeah. You get
right,
you know, edition and Game Rules Rewards, I'm sure.
Yeah.
entertained for about the first 5 minutes.
But the other thing I was thinking about was just, you know, how many times have we seen a Kickstarter that's just, they try to have a version for everything under the sun, and you just wonder how the hell they're going to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel you there.
Yeah. Because, okay. I mean, so, what's the maximum number of systems do you think you've ever seen something for that actually worked for each of those? I'm just kind of curious.
I mean, like, the lighter the rules have to be, the more likely it's going to work across many systems. So if it's like, here's the crazy wizard's shop that, you know, hops dimensions and is on a blimp, that's going to be easier to translate between many different systems than, like, your Haikotoku score gets too high and you change into this kind of freaky zombie thingy. And also you have this dignity score you have to worry about, and there are feats to tie into these things. Like, the more you add on mechanically, the more sluggish it's going to be as you translate it across systems.
Okay. I think you had a question in there, Chris. I cut you off.
Oh. Well, I was just going to ask him, point blank, you've done multiple versions of this game, and you're recently, I guess, what was the hardest thing to translate across genres or game engines? You know, when it comes to the Miss Akuma feel, to make sure it kept the feel. But did you have to, like,
monsters? Monsters, because Shadow of the Demon Lord has a shorter range of challenges for, like, how tough a monster needs to be, and the monster creation rules are pretty much a, you know, look what I do and do like me kind of deal. There's no, like, at least not in the core book. He might have released something in his, like, 100-plus supplements about monster design, but it's kind of a wild west over there for that. So I'd say monsters, translating monsters over and making sure that it didn't get too hard versus too easy.
Yeah, making sure it's still getting the right feel, which is not, we're going to kick its ass, or, oh, how the heck did we survive this?
Can't believe we survived this! Yeah, that's the right
one. Yeah, what do you mean, bees?
Well, you know, you survived the fire swamp, right?
Mm-hmm. When you have your own version of when the county's wrong and they have the rodents of unusual size.
Yes.
You can play a rodent of unusual size. They're called Nezumi Henge Yokai.
Exactly. Well done.
Gazoon height. Yeah.
At some point, there's a second adventure that's part of the Kickstarter. Can I go into that real quick?
Yeah.
Oh, go right ahead.
Absolutely.
There's a previous episode of RPG Circus where we talk about it at length, but yeah. The Imperial Matchmaker is instead of, like, the Trade War takes you all over Sobrin, and Imperial Matchmaker is entirely... I mean, there are some side quests to take you away from it for a little bit, but it's really set in Sanbaoshi, the metropolis, imperial capital. And I've been having a lot of fun preparing for that because, like, I already have a bunch of it ready because it was for... when I ran the first Kickstarter, there was this guy that just pledged this unholy amount of money to it. And I've been running a campaign for him and his friends since then. And I was like, oh my God, I've got like 50,000 words here. Like, I should just make a book out of this. So it's more an opportunity to, like, just expand and really dive into Sanbaoshi as, like, a 200-plus page source book. But it's centered around these 20 marriages, or 10 marriages between 20 people from four clans that have been sort of, like, warring with one another and spatting for, like, 400 years. And the idea is the emperor wants that to end by forcing these marriages to go through. And the party are invited to a tea ceremony in this house where they witness somebody get decapitated for interfering with these marriages. And then instantly afterwards, a bunch of Bengoshi try to get the party to interfere with the marriages. And that's what Imperial Matchmaker's about.
Yeah, and you know there's going to be at least one guy that's going to be overdone with sake that's going to show up in the wedding and basically just mess everything up, even if he dies in the process. Because there's always that one relative, you know?
I'm like 40% of the way through the creation process for it, and I want to fit everything into it, you know? Like, problems is design creep, or scope creep, they call it, I think.
Oh, scope creep, yes.
At least that's what I call it.
I can make my own maps, and I source a lot of artwork from Ukiyo-e, and you'd be amazed at the stuff you find out of medieval Japan artwork. Like, did you guys see the carp monk in the Trade War book? Because, like, I didn't have to order that. Like, there was existing a monk carp person from a Japanese artwork made like 300 years ago.
Wow.
See, that's
right?
That shit's
not
crazy.
Not unfathomable, but it's getting there.
Yeah, Ms. Fukuma tends to, it's a little bit dangerous to work on because it's really, really easy to do more than you meant to when you started. Yeah,
go down the rabbit hole.
I like
basically.
Rabbit holes, but sometimes you go down a deep one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Trying to think. Any other crazy projects that you're worked on in the past that you'd like to present here, I guess?
Oh, the Book of Exalted Darkness.
Oh, yes.
Do you know of that which I speak?
I think we talked about it last time, but for the argument's sake, again, I will say no.
Did I have the cover ready last time? Have you seen the cover?
I don't even remember, to be honest with you.
I do now. Holy cannoli.
Right?
Yeah, that definitely looks like Darkest Sketch.
So, this is the play is Evil People book. For 5e and Shadow of the Demon Lord. Should be coming out for Shadow of the Demon Lord this week. I'm stoked about that. But that book came together fantastically. It's the whole world is powered by this stuff called Inequa, and it's this fantastic, clean, limitless fuel source that they can use to power like cars and refrigerators and stuff like that. The only problem is that it gives off radiation that elongates the lives of people who are good of heart. So all the evil folk are just sort of like dying out by virtue of aging. And you play one of those evil people, and it's glorious. That's the most recent thing that I've done, and that's 414 page book or something like that. It's
well, you don't do anything small, do you?
I've got this fear about the RPG industry where I'm worried it's... So there's this model that's worked out for RPG producers, right? I'm going to release something small every week. It's only going to be a couple of pages. It's only going to cost like $1 or 99 cents or $1.99, whatever. And its real purpose is just to keep people seeing my name and seeing my company and seeing the thing I'm putting out. Right? Build a customer base. And then over time, those small purchases will become enough that I'm making a decent dollar, which is totally works. My problem is that I don't think anybody would say what?
Oh, I was about to say that's the iPhone app model.
Exactly. Yeah, it's iPhone app model. But like, no. Do you know anybody who got into RPGs because of a pamphlet?
Yes, actually.
Oh,
Introduced a small, well, relative of mine, and I probably shouldn't have, to Kobolds Ate My Baby. And they were hooked, basically became gamer essentially because of that silly experience.
Well, I'm glad that they're the occasional person that got into it because of pamphlets, but I mean, like, for the most part, like, you're the first person I've said that to that's been like, yes, I do have an example.
Yeah.
Because, like, we all got into this because we got our hands on some big RPG book that sucked us in and we haven't been able to get back out.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Oh, absolutely. Like, well, the trend of gaming lately has been trying to make a, you know, let's be honest, we've all grown up with essentially textbooks that are basically reskinned with really cool pictures. Mm-hmm. But there's been a real attempt in the last couple of years. I've seen everything from like 1 to 2 page games. I've seen a whole bunch of them. Such as Lasers and Feelings, or the one-page dungeon, or what have you. And there's been a lot of these little projects that have been working on there here, which are great until you try to, you know, hi there. That's great. And you kind of have to use it as part of your marketing thing, because the basic gamer, you know, if you want to get somebody new into gaming, you don't present them with a textbook. You present them with something much smaller. And honestly, Mike, I think that what you're doing is a really good idea.
I mean, like, you can give them quick starts, right? Like, you can make a pamphlet out of your giant book to get people in the door, but, like, we should all be making giant RPG books. That's what I'm saying. Like, this is what got me into the industry. I think it's...
Well, again, I think it's safe to assume we're all book addicts in some way, shape, or form when it comes to this sort of thing, so I think it's a great idea, and I think you're doing both sides really well, so we'll see Well, what the results are ultimately.
Well, I'm pretty sure this Kickstarter should do well, because I'm asking for less than we managed to gather on the last one, and one of the books is already done.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's helpful.
Again, once you get in the door, once you get like a thing there and you get a response here. So, at the risk of asking anything too personal, what's your plan when it comes to when it actually is really, like, which sites you're going to be sitting, what podcasts you're going to try to get on and all that, and who are you going to, basically try to see if you can keep the momentum going?
I sat down with James Intricaso earlier today for a tabletop episode on genres.
Oh, right on. That's a good idea.
Cool.
Do genre mashups, and I was like, dude, let's just talk about genre, because genre mashup is a ridiculous term.
Yeah.
We're supposed to do one on Eastern Fantasy soon, but we wanted to have some actual Asian people with us for that, because they should have a voice in that conversation.
That's a good idea. Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you there.
Hopefully we'll get Michael Turney on. He did the Kaidan horror Japanese setting for Pathfinder. Which is great. It's really, it's Onimusha. It's fantastic.
Wow.
Who else am I? I don't know. I gotta hit up the Tribality folks. And a few, I don't know, maybe, I think I have like a half dozen people I need to contact or rather contact again, reply to, that kind of thing. I started looking into getting my books into Barnes & Noble. But we'll see how that goes.
That has
they
to be a tough
already have
sell.
Stuff in. Say what?
I said that has to be a tough sell trying to get that arranged.
It's weird. They apparently already have access through their online stores to Create Space, which is Amazon, and Lightning Source, which is DriveThruRPG. So I just emailed my publisher and I was like, "Hey, man, like, did you realize they apparently already have access to Lightning Source stuff through their stores? And if they do, then why are why don't you handle this?" So we'll see. Hopefully soon with Barnes & Noble. The real problem is getting in bed with the distributors, Alliance, Diamond. Because if you want to get your stuff into game stores, that's the best way to do it. And trying to compete with them outside is impossible.
Yeah.
The
way it works is game store. Go ahead.
I was about to say, and I think that's that's the weird thing. You know, like people. You know, I know a lot of people that go like, "Well, I wish." You know, you should be buying, you know, there's that division, you know, that says you should be buying everything through your local game store. And I'm like, I'd love to, but there's a lot of stuff that they don't carry or they can't or won't in some cases. You know, it's a very tricky thing.
Oh, it's mostly about margins, man. So like,
no, I get it.
For me to sell. Yeah. Yeah. So, well, do you know what the actual break is?
I don't think it's that high. So please enlighten me.
It's shipping. Shipping is the break, right? So if my game store wants to order a book from me and stuff, I can cut my take down to almost nothing, and then it'll compete with like the listed prices for stuff for comparable material through their regular distributors. But they still got to pay shipping on my stuff, whereas the distributors, A, they've already got that lower price through offset print runs and stuff like that. But anything over $300, they'll just ship to the game store for free.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
Right. How am I supposed to, like, how?
Yeah, basically, you're going to the door because you just simply can't get it there. Yeah. No, that, wow. I'm glad the alternative means are getting out there besides the typical brick and mortar things, which, let's be honest, we've seen a crunching of different bookstores in the last 10 years. You know, your friendly local gaming store isn't exactly as common as it used to be.
No, matter of fact, I would say it's very uncommon these days. You know, mm-hmm. I think we've discussed this on the program before where I feel like, you know, someone says, I don't want this to become the model train in, you know, hobby where, you know, everything for a lot of stuff for the model trains is really through specialty websites and all that stuff. And I'm like, you know, if that keeps the hobby alive and it gives people more choices and more offerings, then I don't see the problem with that. You know, I understand from a producer standpoint, that can be tricky.
So I think what he's what Legendary right now is selling the Book of Exalted Darkness for is like $60 price point, and then somebody's got to pay like $5 shipping to get their house, right? It costs $22 to actually print the book. Okay? And then any sales from that remaining, what, 38? A third of that goes to drive-thru, and then me and the publisher split the rest. So we're looking at like, what is it? Yeah, 38 divided by 3, 36, 30, 12. So that's like 1250 or so that we're each picking up. And then in order to, like, if that was on Alliance's, you know, order list, I'm pretty sure that the most that they're going to charge is $50. So the maximum that the game store is going to pay is $25 because he needs to make a 50% markup in order just to keep the lights on, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's just... I promise, I have banged my head on these numbers, guys. There's just no way to do it. Mm-hmm. There's just no way to do it without getting in bed with the big distributors, man.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm just glad you have a vector to get into, like, drive-through RPG and all that, so you at least can bypass a good chunk of those, shall we say, shenanigans in order to get your product out.
Kickstarter is huge for this, too, by the way, right? Because Kickstarter only takes 12% of whatever you get on your pledges. But, like, you know, then you still got to ship it yourself. That's a whole thing. And,
No, I forget the podcast, but we had an episode where we talked to someone, and it was like, he says, yeah, I didn't realize that I was going to need to rent a space for all the books that ended up getting drop shipped at my house that I shipped from my house. He says, I had books in my house for months.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. Yeah, you got to pay for storage. Yeah.
Yeah. It. I mean,
if there's international orders, there's extra forms you got to fill out. Yeah.
So my hat's off to anyone that produces that. I'm going to bounce
a crazy idea off you, Mike, because I've bounced it off Jeff in the past, but I wouldn't mind getting a different opinion here. I was listening to another podcast, an angry one, if he ever decides to make contact, you know, he's more than happy to be on the show. And he brought up the concept of how we're basically disseminating how we teach new gamers the same old way. Even though the numbers are increasing, they're only increasing incrementally. Almost using a mentorship program. Do you see something similar on your side when you're producing new product where it feels like you're giving them a book and they better have at least some other gamer in there in order to help present them stuff? And if so, how do you get over that hurdle? And if not, how do you see it otherwise?
Oh, well, I mean...
yeah.
We're not... Gaming isn't getting into Stanford. And I don't know. I understand that some people have trouble with the concepts when they first sit down, but most people who are getting into the industry now and the like big boom of gaming consumers are from seeing it on Critical Role and stuff where professional actors show them literally like this is how you play an RPG. I'm amazed that people didn't just understand that. Right? Like if I tell you, oh, me and my friends make up characters and we sit around a board and roll dice that determined, you know, whether or not a character succeeds or fails at what they're doing. This, to me, does not require a 3-hour video to explain how it works.
Well, again, role-playing is ultimately a game of make-believe with limitations and rules.
Right. Like, look at you. You just did it in a sentence. Like, why is it... I think... So the notion that
I was going to say one of the early descriptions I always heard, and this is way back when, was it's basically playing cops and robbers with rules.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
As long as you don't try to sell with, you can do anything. I think that'll solve a lot of the newbie problems where I can do anything. I'm going to do this. You can't do that.
And congratulations, if you're playing you just got somebody or whatever. You can go and do anything. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, true, but I think you would appreciate not having clowns show up in your Mists of Akuma game.
I mean, clown can show up. I don't know how long they're gonna do, but you know, all are welcome.
Exactly. But that's part of it.
Yeah, I don't know.
You have genres, you have tropes, you have different ideas. Like Traveler plays different than Miss Bakuma, or plays different than 50. You know, let's say Risk, just for argument's sake, because I always love bringing up my boogaboo there.
I don't think there should be like.
And, you know, every game has its own, I guess, feel, for lack of a better term. And I think one of the great emphasis right now in the hobby is trying to build the game zero game. Basically, you have an 8-year-old child and you want to make them do a gamer. How do you do it? And it's been kind of fun hearing some of the different answers they can get there.
I mean, I was trying to play D&D when I was 8. So, yeah. You know, I don't like the idea that I don't believe we should have a gate to gaming. Like, there shouldn't be like a gate that we put up. Like, you must do X and X and X and X to join us. But I do like the idea of there being a hill to climb.
Yeah.
To get up to everybody else. Like, we all read the book. You need to read the book. It's not hard to read the book.
Yeah, because, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned being 8 and gaming. It's like, let's see, how old was I? I don't even know. It was, what?
I remember trying to understand Thaco and failing horribly.
Well, I guess I was 8 or 9, or maybe a little earlier. And, you know, it's weird because I always tell people the way I got into gaming. I mean, I'm so old that AD&D was out, and I don't even remember how long that had been out when I started gaming. Probably just several years. You know, a few years. And, you know, because I was easily in the second, third grade, which puts me at 8 or 9. And, you know, I, at the time, I had this huge interest in medieval life and just a little bit of fantasy. You know, at that age, I probably, you know, I've heard about wizards, but it's not like today where it's like, oh my God, wizards, you mean Harry Potter? No, you know, think older legends, you know, think Merlin, you know.
Merlin was a bard, but continue.
I'm just saying, I'm just using that as kind of an example. But it's fascinating. It's like, how did I, you know, I learned by reading the book. You're right. I don't know. It's weird because it's like, you know, when I gamed, I remember, I mean, here I am. I remember, you know, gaming then. And then obviously when I hit seventh, eighth grade, I was, you know, here I am. I'm in junior high, and yet I'm gaming with people that are in college. And I always found that to be a very,
I did that.
You know, and it's like, you know, and I tell people, it's so weird because they did not look at me like, oh, you're only in junior high. Why the fuck are you playing with us? It's weird that that's where I got more inclusion then than I got with my own age group at the time.
You know? Yeah. No,
it's kind of fascinating to me, you know, and that's why for me, I'm always big about, you know, I don't care how old you are. It's like, hey, you want to learn? We can learn. We can teach you. Most of the games I've ever played, I don't think are that complex. I mean, a lot of the games, they taught me things. It's like, there's a reason that I became fairly good at math. There's a reason that even though my spelling was horrible, my reading skill was at a college level, you know?
Yeah. Well, you have to read all the different things. You learn terms like Fouchard or Glaive Goosem, which will thank Gary Gygax for knowing what the heck it is.
You know?
Okay, I got a strange question I might as well ask both of you guys here just to be on the fun side.
I should throw out that Legendary Games does have specifically geared for young kids products, both like that are standalone and include D&D and Pathfinder.
All right, we'll hit this last question.
I didn't work on them. Check them out. Let me know on your own accord that they exist.
I was about to say, we'll hit your last question, then we probably should get into the Kickstarters.
Okay, yeah, it's a very simple one. Like, it's a little different than the one I think we asked when we first said there. It isn't so much what the first game you played is. What was the first medium that got you into gaming? Kind of like, did you see a movie that basically, I don't know, rocked your socks? Or did you read a book that came out during the time and you said, I want to do that?
Mine was a combination of things. So my sister played D&D. Which I tried to play with her group once. Didn't work out great. I was too young. Then there was Record of Lodoss War, which used to be on Sci-Fi Channel. Something that was called the Sci-Fi Channel. And that's like what that is somebody took first edition D&D back in the day over to Japan, started a game there. That became serialized in a manga, and then the manga became an anime. And the first season of the anime is great. It's watching Japanese people reimagine European fantasy is fantastic and so good. So check out Regular Lotus War. And then the other part was my mom and my sisters were into LARPing. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. My mom was a hippie. They also forced me. Well, I shouldn't talk about that. But yeah, my mom was a hippie and played in a LARP, and so there was like definitely pro D&D vibes in the house.
Oh, that's great, man. Okay, unless there's anything else, I think we're ready to move on.
Yeah, I was about to say. I guess for me, if you want to use movies as a basis, definitely movies like Excalibur.
Oh, which, heck yeah!
Which was 1981, which is crazy when you look at who's in it.
Yeah.
And then, strangely, I don't know why I even saw it. I mean, it's just this weird low budget fantasy movie, The Sword and the Sorcerer. It was really weird. And I remember a lot of players at the time were like, oh, that's really cool. I want the tri-bladed sword. You know, I don't know if either one of you guys have ever seen that.
Actually, I think I may have somewhere in the back of my head here.
It's weird because I think that's the right one. I think it's the... Because I want to say it has like this weird tri-bladed sword, and I think two of the swords on either end shoot off or some bullshit like that. It's really like
no,
I said,
and I think I have seen this.
Yeah, it's a weird it's been movie, a while. But I'm just saying, okay. You know, at the time, and then of course, a lot of kung fu movies at the time. You know, a lot of low budget. You know, USA Network used to use a lot of martial art movies, and that didn't hurt.
Oh yeah, the old Xena and Hercules series were amazing.
Nice.
That was much
Kiss the
me.
Prince of Thieves. Oh my god.
Yeah. Oh, at the risk of bringing a side tangent before we head off to the other thing, around in the last couple of weeks, I saw a movie I hadn't seen in 30 years. Yore. And yes, it's about as well as you remember.
Yore.
That does sound familiar.
But again, if you're going to slide with a pterodactyl, I can imagine worse fates.
You're Hunter from the Future. Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That's right up there with the old Beastmaster.
Yep. Indeed.
Oh, the movie's called Yore?
Yeah.
Yore.
Y-O-R-E.
Y-O-R.
Y-O-R. It stars a very young Reb Brown.
Oh shit! I'm gonna find this. Yeah,
I got a feeling it might be your next game if you get in the right mode.
Maybe I have been pondering like a pre-Civilization setting. We'll see.
Well, absolutely, man. Like your game design abilities are without reproach. So you know above reproach. So they're amazing, man. Like. I've enjoyed your work for quite a few times. I enjoyed the game you ran quite a few years ago now, you know, with our group and all that. So I look forward to seeing the success of this campaign and many, many games to come.
Thank you. I also look forward to seeing that.
Yeah, for good reason.
All right, so let's get into the Kickstarters. First up, let's go with... What was that?
Definitely good reason.
Oh.
But yeah, let's talk about Kickstarters.
Where am I here?
What are you looking at today?
I think first up, we're going to go with the Books of Monsters and Legends for the Iron Claw role-playing game, which is an anthropomorphic fantasy RPG. I know over the years I've seen several supplements for this or even the Kickstarter for this. I can't even remember. It's the only reason I even know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So... And, you know, it's weird because definitely I wouldn't consider myself a big fan of this thing, but I always find the concept interesting, you know. I think it's because, you know, okay, I've read, like, the Redwall books and some other things that kind of fit in this category, and then there are people that this is the only thing, you know, they are very big on anthropomorphic fantasy. I mean, it's almost a separate thing. You know, there's no humans. I mean...
Oh, I did a lot of editing for Pony Finder. And then I lost it. And I just gave them, like, a style guide. And I was like, look, just follow this style guide and you don't need an editor. And they haven't called me since. And I've heard their books are better now.
Yay! Well, that's good.
Templates are awesome.
I took the gig because I needed the money. And my friends were like, oh, no, don't work with him. Because, like, yeah, the copy they turned over was just the worst. But I remember going through it, and I wasn't enthused because, like, I'm glad that people enjoy Pony Finder and that kind of thing. You have fun.
It's okay.
But there was some cool stuff.
You don't personally like
this Phoenix Wolf class or race where I was like, okay, wait a minute. I would totally play a Phoenix Wolf. You know, so like there's some really cool stuff in there, but like, yeah, the basic premise kind of sets people away where it's worth looking and seeing what other things they're doing aside from the very obvious,
right?
I am a two-legged cat person.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
although, anyway, yeah. On fire, and I agree.
It's a cool idea. I was like, son of a bitch.
Yeah.
So the good news is that these guys for this book of monsters, they have actually reached their goal, which wasn't that much.
And, their goal.
They still got another 28 days to go. So,
because
what are they looking for? The PD. That's the fiction book.
Yeah.
Okay, so the Book of Monsters, I guess you can get for $9.
Okay, 19 bucks for the starter kit, I think.
Yeah, Book of Monsters is $9, and the starter kit includes a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah,
it includes the Omnibus, the monsters, and option to buy a book for additional cost.
Yeah.
So.
Which is cool. I mean, I think for something like this, where I see this as more. Let's be honest. By our reactions, you probably figured out that this is, in my mind, it's a little bit smaller, a segment of the market. You know, doing. You know, basically making it digital and with an option for some sort of print on demand that you can pay some more from is not a bad method.
So I live in Pittsburgh, where we have AnthroCon every year, which is famous for being the world's biggest furry convention.
Okay.
And I met this guy before Kickstarter and stuff who like leveraged everything to get a loan from the bank to make, and I'm so jealous of this guy because I know he's got to be rich, basically Magic the Gathering for furries. And like I remember looking through the cards, like, oh my god, you brilliant son of a bitch, because they bring in a ton of money to Pittsburgh. Like, if the convention moved cities, it would be kind of a problem, because like we kind of anticipate the, I think it's like $12 or $14 million they bring with them every time they're here for a weekend. So like,
it's kind of like whenever
good to have a local con is worth a darn.
Yeah, it's like when Gen Con finally moves from Indy, whenever that is, that's going to hurt that city pretty bad.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
Because it's like, because I mean, they've had it year after year, and I think somebody, what the hell was the number that I heard? It was something ridiculous, like, you know, a Super Bowl brings in more money, but they only get a Super Bowl how often? And it was something ridiculous, like a fifth. It's like the Gen Con brings in about a fifth of the income of a Super Bowl for them. Which,
wow.
I mean, if you think about that monetarily, that's a huge amount, and they've been doing that for so many years. It's like, that's really big for them.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to find out if it's the same thing after the 50th anniversary, which definitely got sold out.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting. 25,000 attendees.
Yeah. So.
The only place I've had a couple conversations with people about it. I can't see Gen Con going anywhere but Vegas, and I don't think anyone wants to take it to Vegas.
Yeah,
but basically it's going to be Vegas or it's going to be Chicago, and those are basically because you need a bigger city.
Yeah.
You know, and those have both pros and serious cons with them, so.
Yeah, I agree. Even though Vegas would be closer for me, I'd rather take my head and beat it against the wall and go back to Vegas. Sorry for those people who live in Vegas, but it's just not my city.
Yeah.
So, next up we have Arcadia, the mythic Greek setting for 5th edition. Hey, you know what? I'm all for these because, you know, I always like, I don't know, there's something about Greek and Roman stuff for fantasy games that I've always liked. And I think some of it has, especially the Greek stuff, I think it has to do with like some of the old things like Jason and the Argonauts, the old school one with the stop motion.
New Argonauts animation. By Sean K. Reynolds.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's it. It's like, it's weird though. There's a lot of these different ones for, I mean, this one obviously reached its goal. But it's weird. Isn't that weird how we keep redoing these, obviously, for each setting? And I think it's always interesting to see what different takes people have on the same source material. If that makes any sense?
Well, they're not strictly... they're not just reproducing ancient Greece. They're making a setting inspired by ancient Greece.
Right.
And a number of other things.
Right. Yeah. No. But my point...
That's a distinction that's important.
Right.
But yeah, there's certain, like, you know, tunes that everyone wants to hear the drum corps play.
Yeah.
Right.
So, well, like we said before, if traditional fantasy / Renaissance are one, and ancient Egypt and Norse is two, Greek's definitely a three. Maybe even a two, you could argue that. You know, it's the off-brand, but still within the genre, if that makes any sense.
It's got a huge cinematic history, Greek films, right? I am Spartacus! Go ahead and yell that anywhere, and you will hear somebody be like, I'm Spartacus.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Indeed.
Yeah, you know, the only setting I think that I know people have tried, but I don't think it never really gains the traction, is the whole Arabian Night. I mean, that's a very, very common setting, but I think that's one of those ones mm-hmm. that it just never seems to work out the way people think it does.
Well, there were a couple Callum Shan books from the 3-0 days set in Forgotten Realm. Callum Shan was essentially the,
Yeah, well, and there's Al-Qadim, there's... But honestly, you know, I think I remember, which actually covers both Greek and the Arabian settings, of course, is Ray Harryhausen, which we talked about many a time on this podcast.
Yeah. So.
But yeah, no, it's only $10 for the actual PDF. It looks relatively good. It's 50. And it's always fun to... Well, again, it's... Greeks are the greatest hits. There's a lot of stuff you can do with it, especially... Well, it depends how tragic or exciting you want to go when it comes to that stuff here.
Well, yeah, I mean, just some...
What
I
the
mean,
heck?
There's so many monsters and almost...
Thread?
Yeah,
it's a blog. It's not, I didn't make a product. It's just a blog.
Oh, okay. You did a blog entry where you... Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I got like 20 blog entries about that one.
I understand completely.
All right. So next up, we have one that I just kind of thought was a little interesting just from the initial tagline, which is I love how they have just the letters R, P, and G uppercased in their thing. It says word playing cards, action card, role playing game system. And, you know, it's like 6-sided dice and 100 action cards is the way they describe it. Now, they're asking for almost $9,000. And it doesn't look good. I don't know what your guys' feeling on this. It's like we've had many RPG-related stuff that involves cards, and I just always think that falls flat for most people.
Well, I guess with a card game, you got to have a market first. Like, because now it is the most likely way to make money. Let's be honest. This is why Wizard of the Coast was able to buy Dungeons & Dragons.
Well,
there is a market. There is a situation here. Heck, Mike, you just finished talking about those furry games.
It's so much easier to perpetuate. And so, like, okay, so, for instance, I need art for my book. The smallest piece of art that I'm going to buy is a fourth of a page, which is, 2.75 by 3.5 inches?
Yeah, sounds about right.
For card artwork, what do you want, an inch by an inch? Costs nothing compared to what an RPG illustration costs. So, like, the ground up, the cost to make a card game is much lower than it is to make an RPG book. This guy's mistake is that he thinks he needs to make an offset print run. He does not. He could do this through, like, on-demand card printing and give out, like, there are ways he could do this to make this succeed, but not with an offset run.
Okay. So that's good to know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's interesting, but, I don't know, not interesting enough for me.
You can you can make a competition a lot easier, a card game, than an RPG is normally. Which you can use to drive, you know, as marketing, to drive sales, to get people together, like.
I want to say the only RPG that had cards that I thought was really unique was, I think it was an English translation of a Swedish Kickstarter. It was like the Keychain RPG, where they had these
little tiny
cards on a keychain. I'm like, that is really interesting. I don't know if I would fund it, but that is interesting. That, you know, that had a very to me, it had a very unique hook, if you will. So this, not so much for me.
Yeah.
So.
Well. Again, if there's any indication, like you said, probably best to try at a smaller scale and see if you can actually get it through before you start doing a print run. Otherwise, you end up, you kind of want these to fail so you don't end up with a whole bunch of boxes in your basement that you can't do anything with.
Yeah, that's really, you know, I mentioned even early in this episode, it's like, you know, one of the people I know that has done a Kickstarter, I forget who I was interviewing, he was saying that was one of his biggest things. He's like, if I knew how much material I'd end up in my house, you know, he says, that's something I have to take into account anytime I do a Kickstarter calculation that has, you know, stuff that I print. It's like, I have to store it somewhere that's not my house. So, and then, of course, the other big one, of course, is shipping. That's the one gotcha that I think, I know several, I can't even think of them off the head, but I know more than one Kickstarter. The guy's like, I had to borrow money to finish shipping everything. I actually lost money doing the Kickstarter.
Ooh.
You know, it's like,
I had to ship a book to Denmark once. It cost me $40.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Oh, trust me.
Book.
Trust me. I shipped sugar cereal to James Radji, and that cost me a fortune. Because he's in Finland, right? Yeah. And he does,
Scandinavian countries.
Yeah. And he does not have, they don't have sugar cereal there, and he wanted some. So I actually shipped him some, and the cost of the shipping was, I mean, the sugar cereal was like a couple of dollars, but the shipping was like you said, $40, $50. And you're just like, Christ almighty. I'm glad he got it, though.
Go there myself, hand it to you.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Although you never know, you might not get it through customs.
Yeah, fair enough.
All right, so next up we have Under the Witch Moon, which is described as a tabletop fantasy horror RPG game where the players must find the courage to stand against the dark. The setup sounds familiar.
He might make it still. He's in a suspense-filled spot.
I do have to say I like the title. That's a very catchy title to me. I know that's weird, you know, but it's like, I think it's catchy.
Yeah, that's not bad.
You know, I mean,
I probably would have just gone with Witch Moon, but all capitals. You know, some really big, loud, crazy title graphic.
Yeah.
I also don't play fantasy horror role-playing games, and that would probably be inappropriate for the theme.
Yeah. So, I mean, but he's almost at the halfway point, and he still has 21 days to go, which is always, to me, in a Kickstarter, that's always a good sign when you look at it and like, hey, it's only been a few days. Because it always seems like, to me, if you can get over the halfway hump early, the likelihood of succeeding is usually better.
That is correct.
You know, it always seems like there's this big rush. And then there's a drop off, and then there might be at the end a huge finishing rush, if you will.
It's like 40-20-40. So the first, I want to say, 4 days of your Kickstarter, you're going to make 40% of what your Kickstarter is going to make. And this is assuming that you don't blow up and go like insane, you know, and get like $2 million or whatever. But for most Kickstarters, it's 40% in that first week, 20% for the rest of your campaign until the last week, where it's the other 40%.
Mm-hmm.
I know he might be, yeah. I mean, like he's a super suspenseful spot because, like, it could, if a bunch of other stuff comes out and people decide to back other things, what have you, it could not fund, but it's in a place where it definitely still can, and. Yeah, definitely one to watch if you are liking Kickstarters for the drama of it.
Yep. So next up we have. I always find these little tiny Kickstarters interesting just from the fact that, hey, I don't even know why they're. It's like it's almost weird why you're doing a Kickstarter. You almost might as well, because I mean, the person in question is in Singapore, and they're producing A Rude Awakening, a one-shot module for Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition. And there's the conversion from the Singapore money to American dollars was like $146. And they already have $131 equivalent dollars. And so the PDF is like $1.50. So, you know, I'm a big fan of, hey, you know, it's a one-shot. entry-level game, you know, entry-level module. Who couldn't use another one? And, of course, for me, I'm always interested in seeing what people across the pond are making. That's just me.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it's like one of the things I think we've talked at length before is that people just have different, you know, different cultures have different opinions on kind of what an adventure can be. And so I always find that even in what I would call the modern internetization of games, we still, it's always interesting to see that. So.
This is interesting. I'll back him for a dollar. I'm going to back this guy for a dollar.
Yeah. That's what I mean. You know, it's
actually dollar. It's $1.47 to get the PDF. I'll go for that. I'll do it.
Yeah. That's what I mean. It's like for me, it's like, oh hey, you know, $1.50. That buys me a soda, practically, if I go to the vending machine. You know, so it's like, hey, sure, why not? I'm always a big fan of, you could always use one more adventure, even if you just steal ideas from it.
Well, yeah. The whole point of grabbing somebody else's adventure is they're never going to know how you used it on their gaming table. So if there's something cool in there, then it's good. And if not, one less copy.
Yeah. All right, so next up we have... Oh, hey, I can't scroll. There we go. Era, The Chosen, a horror RPG, apparently to defend the dimension. And, you know, you said you weren't a big fan of the horror games. I think I'm kind of with you on that. The only horror game I kind of like to play is, strangely enough, is Call of Cthulhu. But I think it's that I like playing Call of Cthulhu in kind of either the 1920s or... Honestly, I like it around like the late 1930s, early 1940s. You know, I don't know why, but I just love Call of Cthulhu and Nazis as a game setting.
I don't want to tangent, but have you played Requiem for? Let me look. God damn, Eternal Darkness. It's called Eternal. It was a GameCube game called Eternal Darkness.
Yeah, no, I haven't played that one.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that one.
Okay, you guys need to make a note right now if you like Cthulhu, because that game is the best. It does stuff where, like, so you have a sanity, and I'm not going to tangent, but you have a sanity meter with your health, and the further down your sanity goes, the more the game fucks with you. So, like, you'll see a fly onto your TV, and you'll go to, like, smack at it. And by the time you go to smack at it, another one shows up, and you realize it's not a real fly, and then suddenly flies fill the screen, and then you're walking into the room that you open the door for. Or, like, it'll tell you it erased the entire game file and your memory card. Like, it was brutal.
Ooh.
I cannot explain to you how amazing of a game it is.
Yeah, that's true horror when you watch your computer go goodbye, or even if it isn't true.
Yeah, it was like, oh, it's so good. It's so good.
Wow.
It looks cool, though. The art looks nice.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, and I guess this one's interesting just because they have three... time period options: the Renaissance, the Industrial Revolution, and then a modern day. So, not sure how quite that works, but hey, that's interesting.
It's your typical Firewood thing. They're spooky things coming in from beyond the pale, and they're going to do horrible things to you if you don't stop them.
Yep. That's kind of the typical. All right, so let's see what else we have. We have a Pathfinder RPG module. Path to Yawnborg? I think that's Yawnborg. It says
it's like a yarn, yeah.
Sure. Well, I'll go with that.
It kind of looks slightly Germanic or Dutch to me in name. So, a found by the way location module for the Pathfinder RPG with a mystery twist. Short version is we're launching.
Yawnborg is a village founded and populated mostly by dwarves with a few human halflings and gnomes filled in and focus on the forge of a legendary weaponsmith. So basically, yeah, it sounds kind of neat, you know? Nothing too...
I'm surprised he's releasing something for Pathfinder, because most people have moved on. They're like, oh, 2E's coming. I'm going to get some stuff ready for that.
Well, they actually make a comment that says both modules will be compatible with the current edition of Pathfinder, and they will include conversions notes to meld them with the playtest second edition if needed. So, but that's interesting because you're right. That is a big gamble for them.
Well, you're not really allowed to do it. But, yeah.
So, I'm guessing it was probably already done, and then he basically was getting ready to do this, and suddenly he found out there's a totally new edition coming out, so now he's kind of scrambling.
Right. And I don't expect Paizo to like really police that very much. I'm sure if I released a 300-page book to be used with the Pathfinder 2nd Edition playtest, they'd come down on me. But this is
yeah, like you're waiting for that, like what happened with 5th Edition just recently. When is the OGL coming out? Like there was that one period like for what, is a year and a half? Where nobody knew what was happening here and you were afraid to do anything.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Frog God guys forged ahead, so a couple of us were like, well, they're doing it. Just going to point at them.
Exactly.
They're a bunch of lawyers, so, yeah.
Hey, that's actually one of your best friends if you ever run a gaming company is to have a really good lawyer, because you never know.
They are all attorneys. So, like, if the attorneys are like, you know what, we have the legal precedent to get away with this, then, yeah, of course we're going to go for it.
Absolutely. Like, to this day, I have nothing but the highest respect for Dave Kenzer, who's basically slumming it by running a gaming company despite being a full lawyer.
All right, so next up we have one right up your alley there, Mike. Blackstar Death and Decay Creature Codex. It's a licensed product, supposedly, for Shadow of the Demon Lord.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I saw this coming out. Yeah, this is cool. I'm a little angry and jealous because I've always wanted Sean Carroll work on one of my Kickstarters, and every time I ask him, he's like, I'm too busy.
Ooh.
And he's a Kickstarter goal right over here. So I'm watching you, Sean. And I'm sure he's like, okay, Mike.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they definitely reached their goal already, so that there's definitely a plus there for
it's cool.
That.
And Rob Schwab is directly involved with this, too.
Yeah.
Yep.
I didn't realize they were based in Milan, Italy. That's dope.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I didn't know. You know, that's the great thing. Like I said, that's the great thing about RPGs now. They're just all over the place. Pick a country. It's here. It's there. Okay.
Yeah. Works and again, if you have a soft deployment, it doesn't really matter. You can do it from free. Okay. If somebody ever writes an RPG in Antarctica, we will find. Let us know.
All right. So next up, I have to say I like this idea, which is create your own fantasy RPG adventure, RPG resources book. And they were only asking a grand. And it's funny because, you know, Jim Ward, Leonard Lefokin, John Ford, and some other people, I guess, shared some tips. And some guy, you know, been mashing it together.
Yeah, I remember seeing this come out. I don't know. I'm of a... I have a lot of arguments with my wife about this. I don't like reading instruction manuals. I like figuring out stuff by using it. So the whole concept of, like, here's a world-building book and so on, I really don't like them.
Well, it's the old saying goes, you can build anything. Here's a piece of paper. Right. The real test of a game designer is, can you actually build anything with that piece of paper? You have something already in the back of your head to already build beyond that.
Yeah.
My concern is something that comes up with grad schools, right? They don't want to have what they called it academic inbreeding is what they called it.
Well,
so like if everybody learns to make their world using this world book, then all the worlds are essentially going to have a sameness to them.
Right.
And that's not cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I know.
Certainly has a place, and if you're the kind of person who's like spends a lot of time reaching, like, oh man, what should I do for these magic items? Like, you know, this is probably.
Well, I understand the need for scaffolding when you're first starting out, but you get to a point where, yeah, I'm building something that literally has nothing like what I'm seeing right now. So that's when you find out when you're truly trailblazing.
All right. Let's get on to the last two Kickstarters and then do the bundle horns so we can get this thing in the hole.
Sure.
This is kind of a weird one that I thought was interesting. They're only about a third of the way through their goal, and they still got 21 days, so it looks a little shaky, but it's called Free Spacer, a sandbox starship tabletop RPG. And it's weird because the way they describe it, Free Spacer is a sandbox science fiction game about a crew of a commissioned starship and a quadrant-wide Cold War. There's exploration, trade, investigation, space combat, side projects, infiltration, and troubleshooting. We play to find out how the crew gets the job done and the choices they make, the rules they break, and the lengths they go. For patrons, where the hell was it? This was the interesting part. The crew, you play the crew of a starship. The starship acts as a template for your crew and the type of contracts you can take. Huh. I don't know. It almost sounds like you kind of figure out what kind of starship you want to pilot and then, you know, have. And then from there, that determines what kind of characters people can have on it. I thought that was a little weird. A little interesting.
Well, I mean, points for creativity and originality.
I mean,
somewhat.
That's just the way it seems to be described to me. So,
like the Cold War phase thing he's got down here.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, you, the game master, figure out what the factions are doing. Don't worry about the players right now. That's not this phase of the game. It's the Cold War phase. Just figure out what the factions are doing. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think it's safe to assume anybody at this podcast can probably end up creating something really cool just in a few minutes. Just pull from your knowledge base and I guess build something really kind of fun. Like You could have transhumanic octopuses fighting evil space commies for all intents and purposes. And just a little, you know, seed of an idea could really go a long way in a game like this. Especially since it's drawing on some of my favorite, like Cowboy Bebop, Dark Matter, Farscape, which I still one of my faves, Firefly, Killjoys, Big Honey, and the Works of Heinland. So you can definitely tell what sort of genre they're going. We're cool people with guns.
Yep. All right. Last up, we have Knights of Pain Town, a new story arc for Assists, City of the Mist RPG.
City of Mist. Yep.
So, have either one of you ever played City of the Mist?
Actually, yes. We just sort of finished a game where we're basically ended up playing in a computer with based on 50s America that's based on a fake version of basically the Korean War, just after the Korean War. But instead, it's Americans in Oz for all intents and purposes. Hmm. So, yeah.
So, oddly, this, I guess we must have missed it because this is not in the last podcast. This only has a few days left and they definitely hit their goal. So if you listen to this late, you're going to miss it.
Well, they got a day or two when the thing drops. And if not, we wish them well, of course.
Yeah. So, all right. Last up, let's do, well, my favorite part, which is the bundle of holding, which is always a fun grab bag. As I like to call it. And it's weird because the first one up, I'm a big Savage World person, and I don't think I've heard of this stuff.
Yeah.
Is that weird? But so
we're talking Beasts and Barbarians?
Beasts and Barbarians. And so, you know, obviously.
For a second there, I thought it said Beasts and Barbarians, and I was so confused.
Oh, Beasts and Barbarians?
I was so confused.
Yeah, you know,
version of Vegetarians. Really horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, damn those right. Beets, you know.
Exactly.
So, I mean, they are
Rage!
Yeah. they're obviously when you do Bundle of Holding, there's a small fee of that goes towards a charity of their choice, and they are actually doing Doctors Without Borders.
Always a good choice.
Yeah.
Full kudos and credit on that one.
So that's kind of cool. And then next up for you 40K people, might as well cover them. We have the Death Watch Essentials.
Mm-hmm.
And they are doing two. Well, it's weird because they're actually doing two different ones. I can't. One is Doctors Without Borders. Oh, I see. We'll split even between two. And the other one is a German children's home, which I can't even, I'm not going to.
Achrenhurst.
What was that?
I'm seeing if the Google Translate
is a rough
idea. It looks like some sort of hospice.
Yeah, it's a children's home for
terminally ill children in Wiesbaden, Germany.
Yeah.
So if you want to save children in Germany, this is your thing.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think they're being saved. I think it's just giving them the best time they can get.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, I'm not going to dig too hard on that one.
And then,
oh, Baron Herb Stiftung Kinderhospiz.
Okay. Yeah, it's still
beat. Yeah, I think it's like basically the German equivalent of Bottom McDonald House, but
yeah, that's kind of what I was guessing at. And then, of course, they have obviously the Deathwatch Essentials, and then on the other side, they also have the Deathwatch Missions. So if, hey, Warhammer 40K, and you're missing some stuff out of your Deathwatch set, this may be a good way to acquire that, at least in PDF format.
Indeed.
So, and I think that's it, because we talked about one dice last time, and there's only a few days left on that, too.
Yeah, well, so there, and, if you want it, you still got time, but you got, actually, you got about a week.
Yep. All right, well, I think that's it for this episode, unless you guys have any final comments?
I'll send you guys a link to put on the thingy on your page for one of the free PDFs.
Okay.
For folks to check out. When is this going to go up? Is it going to go up on Saturday?
No, this will go up
Sunday
tomorrow.
Probably the next day or so.
Tomorrow?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'll definitely give you some links to share with folks so you can check it out. And if somebody sees something, some way I can improve the Kickstarter page, please let me know.
All right.
Hopefully y'all submit and pledge.
All right, sounds good. And with that, I think if anyone has any comments, they can obviously send me an email at info@rpgcircus.com. And we'd be more than happy to take any comments and see what we can do with that. And with that, I think we're going to see everyone in about 2 weeks, unless something weird happens, like a vortex opens up. What do you think?
Well, if we have a mysterious circumstance, we'll tell you all about it, and hopefully it'll make great role-playing material.
I want the vortex. I want to know.
RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons Attribution US License 3.0. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.